Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Nagmeh Sarabi, professor of Middle East history at Brandeis University, who discusses how the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran is shattering the lives of average Iranians, including opponents of the Islamic Republic regime. And Froines of the group Back from the Brink, who talks about the U.S. campaign to reduce the threat of nuclear war, made more immediate by Donald Trump's erratic handling of the war on Iran. And Catherine Spiller, executive editor of Ms. Magazine, who takes a critical look at the Heritage Foundation's Project 2026, the Trump administration's blueprint to suppress women's rights. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Weeks before President Trump is scheduled to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping, the leader of Taiwan's largest opposition party, the right-wing Kuomintang, or KMT, will visit China in April at Xi's invitation. KMT party chairwoman Cheng Li-won has signaled closer ties with Beijing than her predecessor. China views Taiwan as its own territory, refusing to speak to its president, William Lee, of the pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party, who Xi labels as a separatist. But Beijing regularly welcomes senior KMT officials. The announced trip comes at a time when the KMT and other Taiwan opposition parties have refused to pass a $40 billion defense package backed by the Trump administration. In 1949, the defeated Republic of China's right-wing government, led at the time by dictator Chiang Kai-shek of the KMT party, fled to Taiwan after losing a war to Mao Zedong's communists. No peace treaty or armistice has ever been signed, and neither formally recognizes each other's government. In late March, a Cambodian court upheld the conviction of two journalists sentenced to 14 years in prison for posting a controversial photo taken in the disputed Cambodia-Thailand border region. The image appeared to confirm claims that Cambodia's army was planting anti-personnel landmines in violation of the United Nations Landmine Treaty. The two journalists were convicted of treason for posting the photo on Facebook that was taken in a restricted military area. In 2025, several rounds of fighting broke out between Cambodia and Thailand on the border, killing dozens of people and displacing more than a million in July through December. Thailand had repeatedly accused Cambodia of placing landmines in the disputed area, which had wounded patrolling Thai soldiers. Cambodia denied the charges. The Committee to Protect Journalists condemned the reporter's conviction, stating equating news reporting with treason is farcical and shows the extraordinary lengths Cambodian authorities will go to suppress the news. Cambodia and Thailand signed a ceasefire agreement in late December, but tensions on the border remain, with both sides accusing the other of truce violations. A third of all American workers now have access to some form of state government-issued paid leave, the biggest share ever. The U.S. is one of the few advanced industrialized nations in the world that doesn't have a federal paid leave policy offering workers paid time off after the birth of a child to address serious health conditions or to care for a sick family member. In the absence of federal paid leave legislation, states and jurisdictions have passed 14 paid leave laws since 2002, which now cover a third of the U.S. population. 10 of those were passed in the previous decade, as public support for paid leave has been on the rise. Today, there are 6 campaigns to pass paid leave laws in Hawaii, Illinois, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Dawn Hucklebridge, director of Paid Leave for All, a national advocacy organization, told In These Times magazine, there are states that will likely never pass paid leave laws. So long as there isn't a federal guarantee, this is going to create a system of have and have-nots that will just continue to grow inequities. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
In the days leading up to April 7th, Donald Trump issued a series of profanity-laced threats to bomb Iran back to the Stone Ages, saying he would order the U.S. military to destroy every bridge and power plant if the Islamic Republic didn't reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Democrats and many Trump allies responded by condemning the threats and declaring that deliberate destruction of civilian infrastructure is a war crime. The U.S. president, who called Iran's leaders animals, warned on the morning of his self-declared April 7th, 8 p.m. deadline, that if Iran didn't make a deal, quote, a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, unquote. But just hours before the deadline arrived, Trump agreed to a two-week ceasefire on condition that Iran reopens the critical Strait of Hormuz. As the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran entered a sixth week, human rights groups report that more than 3,500 Iranians have been killed since the conflict began on February 28th. Your reporter spoke with Nagmeh Sarabi, the Charles Corky Goodman Professor of Middle East History and Director of Research at the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. Here she talks about how the war has shattered the lives of average Iranians, citing the stories she publishes in her These Are the True Things blog, that amplifies voices from Iran, rarely heard in U.S. corporate media.
I think it's really important for us to know that civilian infrastructures have already been attacked. There's a threat as if attacks on civilian infrastructure is looming. It is not looming. It has happened. And I can give you a series of examples. Sharif University was bombed. Sharif University is often considered to be akin to MIT, which is my alma mater also. It is a engineering and technical university. The best students often in Iran go to Sharif University. They're very proud of themselves for doing that. It's hard to get into. It's not the only university that has been bombed. And it's really important to remember that these are civilian infrastructures in that it's a university, so it's a big part of society. It's a big part of the future of any society. But also importantly, if we care about a democratic future for Iran, if we care about Iran becoming opening up and not being under a repressive regime, so many of the protests that your listeners have heard of, for example, in the Women Life Freedom Movement, actually was happening within the grounds of this university, these universities, including Sharif University. So that's one example. Another example, infrastructure. When we talk about infrastructure, we think of electrical grids. We talk about water desalinations. And these are crucial, crucial infrastructures. But for example, last week, they bombed the Mubarak steel factory complex. And this complex is within, it's a built city is around it. And not just the Mubarak, but other ones that they've already bombed. For example, Mubarak is connected to 20,000 households who are being employed, whose livelihood comes out of this complex that was bombed. Now, when we say, well, it's only military and not civilian, we forget that any country's infrastructure is civilian and might have military uses, but they're all complicated and connected to each other. So already that has happened. There is a huge fear since Sunday when President Trump put out his Truth Social in Iran, that what is coming, though, is going to be basically bombing the electrical grids, electrical power plants, and water supplies. That then moves this war from a devastating war that has affected thousands and thousands and thousands and millions of people. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of over 91 million people. This war is affecting every single one of them. But something like that would actually be a turning point, even though civilian infrastructure has been bombed. That would basically be about starving a population and driving them into ground. So Stone Age gives a sense to people that there's nobody there. When we think of a Stone Age, we think about an empty landscape. But Iran is a very densely populated country. And so bombing it into the Stone Age basically would mean that we would not just kill. We keep talking about killing people, but this is not about people who are dead, which is horrible. But it's about how the people who are left behind are going to be able to live.
Thank you for that, Naghmeh. I wanted to ask you to share some of the stories that you've received from people inside Iran during this war and how they've been personally affected, they and their families, on the death and destruction that's been wrought on the country since the start of this war, February 28th.
So I platform a wide variety of people, journalists and intellectuals and artists and writers. And I do that in addition to ordinary everyday people whose job might not be to write. I do that because Iran is a country, it's a highly educated country. And this group of people are really at the forefront of forging a new path despite both the war and the repression. And I platform them because one of the common ideas that comes out of what they're writing and posting on their Instagrams or on Telegram channels, it's a very common idea amongst that segment of the population that it is possible to be anti-war and anti-Islamic government. A false choice has been presented to multiple publics, including our publics here, that if you are against the Islamic Republic of Iran, that you should be for this kind of foreign intervention. Or if you are against this foreign intervention, that means that you support the Islamic Republic. But these people, under this severe bombardment and this uncertainty for the future, are capable of articulating a path forward that says we neither agree with this foreign aggression. We do not agree with the actions of Israel and the United States, not just towards us, but towards the region. Let's not forget that there's over 1 million displaced people in Lebanon in a war that was started on March 6th. It is connected, but it is happening through its own logic. So there is a lot of grief happening in the region, and of course, all the countries in the region that Iran, in response to this aggression, has been bombing. But these people are able to articulate such a nuanced and such a powerful and in some ways hopeful position despite this lack of hope. And I platform it, A, because it needs to be heard, but also because one of the questions I keep thinking to myself is, why do we not have an anti-war movement in America?
That was Naghmeh Sarabi, the Charles Corky Goodman Professor of Middle East History and Director for Research at the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. Find a link to Professor Sarabi's These Are the True Things blog and related analysis and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In late January, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists' so-called Doomsday Clock was moved closer to midnight than it has ever been before, indicating how grave the group considers the threat of nuclear war. Now, with the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran being handled by Donald Trump in unpredictable and dangerous ways, that threat feels even more immediate. After the mobilization of the nuclear freeze protest movement of the 1980s and the disarmament agreement signed by U.S. President Ronald Reagan and Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, the danger linked to the thousands of warheads the U.S. and Russia still maintained took a lower profile. But in the intervening years, both countries have undertaken an extensive modernization of their nuclear weapons arsenals, and all bilateral arms control treaties have expired. With Donald Trump in the White House, concern has surged about the possibility of this unpopular and erratic president making a unilateral decision to launch a nuclear weapon with virtually no checks or balances. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Anne Freunds of the group Back from the Brink, which works to reduce the danger of nuclear war. Here she discusses the threat of nuclear catastrophe and provides information on how individuals can take action.
Positions for Social Responsibility is one of the organizations that launched the campaign. And it has recently become much more active because it has introduced these congressional resolutions concerning nuclear disarmament. It's basically trying to set a new framework for the United States to lead a global effort to prevent nuclear war. You know, after the fall of the Soviet Union and the sort of decline of interest in the Cold War and fear about a nuclear exchange, accidental or intentional, the problem of nuclear armed states kind of disappeared a bit from the public view and was replaced by other issues. This campaign is attempting to put this back on the agenda, particularly with the U.S. Congress. The basic idea of the campaign is to pursue the following goals: pursuing a verifiable agreements among nuclear armed states to reduce and eventually eliminate their nuclear arsenals, to renounce the option of using nuclear weapons first, to end the sole unchecked authority of any U.S. president to launch a nuclear attack, and to take U.S. nuclear weapons off hair trigger alert. And this is very important, too. It's aiming to cancel the plan to replace the entire U.S. nuclear arsenal with enhanced weapons. And this is especially important to emphasize with local community groups doing socially progressive things, with trade unions and so on, because the United States is planning to spend between $1 and $2 trillion in the next few years enhancing nuclear weapons, that is, making new ones and throwing out the old ones. Given the affordability crisis being in front of the Congress and the American people right now about healthcare, education, and housing, this is an important issue that we're trying to stress to get support from congresspersons for these resolutions. And the way resolutions work, they're kind of a statement of intention on the part of Congress people before an actual bill is designed to go before a committee. There are two resolutions, House Resolution 317 and Senate Resolution 323. They have exactly the same content. They're companion resolutions. And we have so far 50 sign-ons, signatures from congresspersons for 317, and I don't know, somewhere between 6 and 12 so far for Senate Resolution 323.
Anne Freund's talking about the $1 to $2 trillion cost. I believe that this whole thing started under the Obama administration. Isn't that right?
It's been a bipartisan issue all along, nuclear funding, nuclear weapons, and nuclear expansion. The goal is to make it a bipartisan issue to slowly bring this under control and to a halt. It really isn't a partisan issue. And I don't think too many Republicans or possibly any have signed on yet. But it's true that the Democrats, as well as certainly under Biden, more money was put forward for this.
The other point you raised about in the resolution, I think, was something like to take away the unilateral power of the president to launch nuclear weapons, right? That is very scary, the existing situation.
This is why we're really stressing the urgency of the timing of this now, too. Given that actually 4 nuclear-armed nations are involved in active or very active wars. And that would be, you know, Russia, the United States, Israel, and Pakistan. That's fighting wars on its borders. So that makes this matter ever more urgent. And then the frightening instability and ignorance about international affairs in our U.S. executive branch should put everyone on alert to trying to participate somehow in this issue.
That was Anne Freunds, an activist with Back from the Brink. Learn more about the group's campaign to reduce the danger of nuclear war and reverse the nuclear arms race by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thank you. As of early 2026, an estimated 51-53% of the Heritage Foundation's on Popular Project 2025 authoritarian policy recommendations, adopted by Donald Trump as his guidestone for his second term agenda, have either been completed or launched. The specific policies implemented include the illegal mass firing of federal employees, unconstitutional defunding or elimination of federal agencies and departments, a violent, indiscriminate nationwide campaign of mass deportation of undocumented immigrants, devastating cuts to social safety net programs, the slashing of critical foreign aid, ending federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, the withdrawal of protections for transgender individuals, and the defunding of public broadcasting outlets, NPR and PBS. The Heritage Foundation's latest policy agenda, titled Saving America by Saving the Family, that many now refer to as Project 2026, advances a new blueprint that pressures women into marrying young and raising children, while deprioritizing education and work careers, in other words, a direct attack on the rights women have fought for and won over the past 100 years. Your reporter spoke with Catherine Spiller, executive director of the Feminist Majority Foundation and executive editor of Ms. Magazine. Here she takes a critical look at the Project 2026 assault on women's rights and expresses her belief that women will fight these policies and never give up on their battle for full equality.
All of this is because they blame feminism for having provided more opportunities and more options and more choices for women today. And they believe it has led to declining birth rates. They're, you know, under the guise of being very concerned about lower birth rates that exist today. They want to allow laws that discriminate against women in the workplace. They see women only as wives and mothers, and they are prepared to offer tax incentives for women who get married young. The typical marriage age right now is 30, and they want to see women marry at a much younger age and start having more children at a much younger age. And so they've structured all kinds of proposed tax incentives and savings accounts that would put money into the pockets of families who abide by these rules they want to set up about young marriage and more children. And notably, it's only really middle and higher income families that they're really focused on. If you're a single mother, head of household with children, those tax benefits and those support mechanisms are not going to go to you. You have to be in a heterosexual marriage where one parent is employed, and that will usually mean the man is employed. And so the woman is staying home in order to get these kinds of tax benefits. They want to limit higher education for women. They feel that too many women have pursued a college degree or a postgraduate degree or law degree or medical degree. They want to limit that. They see that again as taking women away from what they view as our normal role in society, and that is getting married and having children. Interestingly enough, they want to restrict access to birth control even more than they already have, so that women don't have access to birth control and the ability to control the number of children, or if any, that you're having. But they also ban IVF, which seems sort of counterintuitive. However, what they're really after is a definition of when life begins at fertilization, so that you can't have IVF where fertilized embryos are destroyed that are not used. They also, by the way, want to get rid of no-fault divorce. They think that has encouraged divorce. And so they want to get rid of no-fault divorce laws. So they want to make it harder for you to get divorced, even from terrible relationships and marriages, violent relationships and marriages. And all of this is their vision of what the American family is.
Catherine, this agenda also seems aligned with Christian nationalist extremism trying to impose a certain religious ideology on the country as a whole.
Yes, and they blame secularism. Feminism and secularism are the two pillars that they blame for the situation here in this country of declining birth rates. But it's declining birth rates of the white population, the white educated population, that they're really most concerned about. And people, I think, will see that if they spend any time looking at this Project 2026 blueprint. They also talk about restricting voting rights. They think that the vote should be cast by the male head of household for the household as a unit, as opposed to individuals with voting rights. Of course, women fought decades for the right to vote and still are fighting. We have right now in the United States Senate being debated on whether or not they will be able to impose more restrictions on voter registration and voting by requiring proof of citizenship. And there's only a couple of ways you can prove your citizenship. If you are a citizen, and that is with a birth certificate that shows where you were born and when you were born, or with a passport, if you've gotten a passport. And of course, to get a passport, you had to have a birth certificate. So they're saying that those are the only two forms of ID they're going to accept when you go to register to vote. There's a major problem. A lot of people don't have, in fact, over half the population doesn't have a passport, but many people don't have copies of their birth certificate. Getting a copy is time-consuming and can cost money, but beyond which, most women who did get married, 80% or more, changed their names. They either hyphenated their names or they took their husband's last name. And so their birth certificate does not match their current driver's license ID, for example. So now you've got to also come up with your marriage certificate. So they're making it very difficult for women, especially, to register to vote and to prove citizenship. But this impacts poor people disproportionately. It impacts many elderly populations who don't have a birth certificate. Maybe they were born at home and their births were never really registered. So it's going to create a lot of problems where citizens are going to be denied the right to vote.
That was Catherine Spiller, Executive Director of the Feminist Majority Foundation and Executive Editor of Ms. Magazine. Find a link to her article, Project 2026 Declares Open War on Women's Rights, and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.